I'm Tom Warnhouse. I'm with the Institute of Social and Economic Research in Anchorage. Let me just say a couple words about the workshop format this morning. We have till noon. Each of our panel members will have about 20 minutes to make their basic presentations, after which we'll have panel members comment on each other's observations and presentations, and then we'll open it up for audience participation. And anyone here who wants to participate should use that mic in the center of the room since all of this is being recorded. We'll probably break somewhere somewhere between 10 and 10:30 for the 10 minutes or so. Let me introduce the panel. Starting down on the far left is John Borbridge, who is the president and chairman of the board of the Sea Alaska Corporation. Also has a degree in political science, and we'll bring that perspective to bear. Next is John Hellenthal, who was a delegate to the Constitutional Convention, a lawyer. Andy Warwick, commissioner of administration in Juneau at the present time, former state legislature, legislator. Chancey Croft, president of the Alaska State Senate, and John Havelock, former attorney general and currently director of the Criminal Justice Center at the University of Alaska. Some of the major questions that I hope the panel directly and indirectly will address and may come out in the following discussion. Basic question, I guess that the obvious basic question that we're dealing with here is, has the strong executive form worked in Alaska as it was envisioned and played out in the article in the Constitution? But we want to look not only at the formal powers of the governor as laid out in the article, but also at the informal powers of the governor, the relationship between the informal and the formal. In other words, looking at such factors as perhaps the different personalities and styles of the successive governors of Alaska and how they have used, and how effectively they have used, or the different ways in which they have used the formal powers bestowed upon them by the Constitution. We want to look at the changing patterns of relationships between the governor and the bureaucracy. The governor and his immediate staff and his commissioners, which is kind of a transient leadership and interaction with the more or less permanent government, which is the middle managers and all those in the bureaucracy who stay, many of them stay beyond the term of the incumbent governor. We want to look at the relationships between the changing patterns between the executive and the legislative branches, and the changing patterns of interaction between major interest groups in the state and the executive branch of government, the government focusing on the governor. And finally, out of all this, we may be able to come up with some sort of answer to the question, in what ways, if any, need the executive article of the Alaska State Constitution be changed. So with that, I'll turn it over to John Hellenthal, who will speak first of all about the original article, what the delegates to the Constitutional Convention were trying to accomplish, and how they got to where they were. John?
Well, our executive article is noteworthy primarily because it creates a strong executive, and this was a matter of considerable discussion at the convention. They even got back to classic terms like Hamilton and his approach to government, and they adopted the Hamiltonian form of government. In other words, a very strong executive, and it's worked very, very well. Very well, I think. And there's been little criticism of it, although at the outset there was a lot of criticism. New Jersey had this in its constitution, a strong executive. And people questioned whether it would work in New Jersey. It did work in New Jersey, although I'm certainly no authority on New Jersey. And I know it's worked in Alaska. I suppose the strong executive is no stronger than the elected executive. It's possible, perhaps, that someone could abuse it, but no one has. Egan certainly did. Good not. Hickel did not. The present governor is probably criticized more for not being strong enough than for being overly strong. So it's apparently worked very well. The article, I don't know, you've got to be 30 years old to be governor. I'm not so sure that's necessary nor even proper. But that was, in those days, there was always a restriction on age. Pretty well been done away with in modern times. I don't know why I couldn't have a hell of a governor would be 21. I haven't seen one yet that's capable of it, but some fellow might come along someday, and I don't think there should be an arbitrary restriction on his age, but that was a concession to the established view of thinking. It probably hasn't harmed the people at all. I never liked this business about the lieutenant governor. I think it's ridiculous. I thought so when the Constitution was passed. I voted against it. We called it the buddy system of running for governor. And Frank will remember this. I think it only passed by a couple of votes, which shows there was a difference of opinion then. I think it's ridiculous. I think the governor should appoint his own lieutenant governor prior to his election, so the people will know who he's going to choose, at least initially. He'd probably fire him a week later, but it makes no difference. I think it should not be an elective office, and we tried to compromise in some way so that they run in a half-baked fashion together. I think it's utterly ridiculous. I wrote an article about it 7 years ago, and this ensures that both the governor and the secretary of state will be of the same party. Well, there's nothing wrong in that, I don't suppose. But in the primary of 58, there was some criticism of the innovation because of the possibility that successful candidates for governor and secretary, though of the same party, might be a very different and divergent political philosophies. Some believe the Constitution will ultimately be amended to provide that the governor shall appoint the secretary of state, and those some include me. I don't see any damn reason at all why the Secretary of State should be elected, and I think it's a sham. I think it's a ridiculous indulgence. We've had trouble with governors and secretaries of state who clashed, who in fact got to the point where they kind of hated one another. That isn't true today. There's a beautiful affinity between Hammond and Thomas. And I think that's grand, but I don't know if we have any assurances that this will continue in the future. I would just have the governor pick his own Secretary of State, but I think it should be done before the election so that the people will be as fully informed as they can be. But irrespective of it, it's nothing to cause a revolution. No one's going to go to the barricades because of the kind of silly provision we have about Lieutenant Governor, now called Lieutenant Governor. But as an academic thing, I would much prefer it if the governor picked his own Lieutenant Governor. We used to argue, and my God, we really did argue over these Section 25 and 26 boards. But it's kind of funny that passage's time has eradicated that argument, and you don't hear anything about it anymore. But my God, people used to fight in the streets over whether there should be Section 25 or 26 boards in Alaska, and they even referred to them by section, which showed how deep they thought about it. But apparently, this shows that people are basically honest, and they're not going to be a part of a scheme to thwart the well-being of the people of Alaska and the boards, whether they were appointed or whether they were confirmed by the governor or whatever. They've done a hell of a good job, and they fill their jobs well, and the problem has been eliminated. So that doesn't raise any questions anymore. Pavlok thinks that we've got too much talk in here about martial law. Well, hell. That's another concession probably to tradition. What does it say about it? The governor is commander-in-chief of the armed forces of the state. He can call out the forces to execute the law, suppress or prevent insurrection or lawless violence, or repel invasion. Well, tradition more or less requires that. It could be eliminated completely, and I suppose we'd survive, but there it is. There's one thing, though, that's in this Constitution that's generally overlooked, but I think it's a beautiful provision. It's a restriction on martial law, and it's in there because of the abuses that occurred in Hawaii when they declared martial law in Hawaii and kept it in effect for 3 years and built up a ridiculous bureaucracy of hangers-on who appropriated people's homes, lived in them without paying them anything, and acted like a bunch of phonies for 3 years. Total idiots who were, the general happened to like at the time. He'd make a military governor of Maui, a military governor of Kauai, as they thought. And they'd take someone's house and live in it like kings and do absolutely nothing. And Alaska tried to prevent that, and somewhere in here is a restriction saying that martial law shall not continue for longer than 20 days without the approval of a majority of the members of the legislature in joint session. And if the case never demands, we'll be damn grateful to have that, because military constantly demanding martial law. Pavlok said that what was the Cuban invasion? Some idiot wanted to declare martial law in Alaska?
Yeah.
And they'll do it. They're trained that way. Their object in life is to somehow be a military governor with autocratic powers over civilians. And we've got to have a check on it. And I saw the abuses in Hawaii, and they were miserable. So that isn't going to happen in Alaska, hopefully. The 20 departments, that's a strange thing. You know, you could avoid that easy by creating sub-departments and everything else. But the beautiful thing about that Section 22 is that it has acted as a deterrent to the legislature. If they wanted to, they could circumnavigate it beautifully. But the very fact that it exists has deterred the proliferation of unnecessary departments. And I don't, have you ever had more than 16 departments in the last, I don't think so.
19.
They got up to 19 once, huh? Well, anyway, it could easily be avoided, but it hasn't been, so that's a damn good argument for keeping it in there. It's worked. The reorganization, I noticed that's being abused recently. Governor Hammond wants to reorganize the what is it? The transportation setup of the state. This has happened time and time again, and for damn good reasons. I remember Egan, by executive order, split off the public works, split into two departments, transportation and public works, whereas prior to that, the fellow that handled the ferries was also handling the public buildings, which is a there was no affinity whatsoever. So he split it up under threat. The legislature would have done it if he hadn't done it, but he beat him to the punch, and he, by executive order, split the departments. Now Hammond is going to do it again, but I think he's weakened his role by, at the same time, he says he's going to put a bill in the legislature to confirm it. Well, that's ridiculous. He should do it if it's necessary. Then if the legislature feels it's necessary to undo it, they have the right to do it, but I don't think the governor should put a bill to undo what he's done at the time he does it. It's a matter of technique only, but I wouldn't do it that way. If I felt the department should be reorganized, I'd reorganize it, and then I'd raise hell with the legislature if they differed with me. But anyway, the public is not going to be harmed by that in any event. But aside from that, I think it's a good the strong executive, a lot of people had worries about that. You know, the figure dictator, there was a lot of talk about that too. During the ratification, people said, oh God, we're creating a monster. We're going to have a governor who's a Hitler. Never worked that way. In fact, the governors probably haven't been as strong as they should have been, although they have the power to be strong. And I think that's one of the main characteristics of the Constitution, that it's very desirable. As a Jeffersonian Democrat, I immediately took issue with it because it favored Hamilton's views, and Hamilton was kind of a dirty name in Democratic circles, but I think he had a good idea when he thought the executive should be strong. And I think it was a good thing in Alaska, particularly because, our governors had no powers whatsoever up until statehood. Governor was nothing but an errand boy for the Secretary of the Interior. And we wanted a strong executive. We wanted somebody that was answerable, someone that could do things, somebody that didn't have to write letters to Washington or wait for committees to come up here before he did anything. Who was it yesterday? Willie Hensley. He said, all these committees are coming up here. This is one of the reasons we had statehood, was to keep the damn committees out of here. But it seems that we have more committees coming up here now than we had prior to statehood. And it seems that the federal government is still exercising the control over Alaska. They should not exercise. That has nothing to do with the executive branch. But I think the federal government is, I don't know what the answer is, but they still have too damn much control over the local affairs of our own state. It isn't desirable, and I don't think it's efficient. I think it's a rotten form of government. That's all I have to say about the executive.
Did John Crink say, and I'm sure there'll be responses to this as we go, and down the road, you're going to work with him with their presentations, but I think the better moves are letting each panel member have his allotted time. And then we'll open it up further on. John Havelock is going to pick up from here and present a perspective on the evolution of the executive branch from the time of statehood and why it was very.
May I have just one more? There is one problem with the executive branch. It's this problem about the Attorney General, whom I like to refer to as the governor's lawyer. That should be met head on, and I think we should give a lot of thought to divorcing the Attorney General from his other role, which is that of administering the prosecution of criminal offenses in Alaska. And I don't think the Attorney General should have anything to do with that second department. I think that should be handled by the legislature. But this is something I think we should discuss.
I'll try to follow John's model of not using up the full time, but hard to have you out there to hold your attention and for this long time. I'd like to start with a couple of overall comments that are picking up where John, the delegate, left off. In reading Vic Fisher's book on the Constitutional Convention, I noticed he cited this one form of criticism of the Constitution in it, where somebody said that, as I recall, unidentified person, maybe it was a newspaper at the time, this is at the time that the Constitution was coming up for confirmation. The comment was that it was a managerial Constitution. And I think that's a valid observation on the form of the Constitution. I'm not sure it maybe more of an observation than a criticism, unless you say that, that what that means is there were more Hamiltons and Washingtons at the convention and fewer Jeffersons. That is, there is more emphasis on this, on the distribution of managerial responsibilities according to their nature, and less thinking about rights, the kind of rights that might be relevant to the century ahead. But most of the critical part of what I would say belongs in other groups on that. What we're talking about, it seems to me, is the very best part of the Alaska Constitution. Like the executive article is the best article because it does provide a sound distribution of managerial responsibility based upon separation of power. As John Helenthal mentioned, the signal feature of the executive article is that it provides for a strong central executive. And I suppose the question today is, has that worked? It's in contemporary context that we tend to, when not thinking in state terms, we think in national terms. And of course, in the national perspective, people are more worried today about concentrations of power nationally in Washington, too much power in the executive branch, too much power in government. Those concerns were around then, but the strong central executive people prevailed. And I think in the light of the last 20 years of history, it's a very fortunate thing that they did. I don't think this state could afford, with the small population and the enormous areas, the luxury of having the executive branch split up into competing executive departments. Of course, that was the experience that John well knows of the territory, was that the executive branch was split up. There was a diffusion of responsibility among a lot of boards and commissions. Also, I think that the strong executive branch has helped to resist the centrifugal forces of intersectional combat. As you start dividing up the executive branch, and you're going to find out that some sections get stronger with some branches of that executive department and some others. I think the strong executive has helped to hold together a state which has as many varieties of opinion and point of view based upon regional differences as any state in the Union. Also, and I think maybe the most important factor, and coming from personal experience, is the that you needed, with a small state, big responsibilities, you've needed to have a strong and unified executive branch in order to deal with the other entities. As we have been from the beginning, in dealing with big oil, big government in the form of Washington and the Washington bureaucracy, interior, big labor, powerful groups both in and outside the state. And I can just, thinking of the elected AG thing, and what would have happened if you had had an elected attorney general as another focus of executive power in the state over the last 15 years in attempting to deal with Washington. Imagine Egan or Hickel trying to deal with Washington or with some of these big oil companies. He's got another center of executive authority, an attorney general, who of course is going to take a somewhat different position. And both, let's say, in the Settlement Act and the fight for the pipeline, it would have been a very difficult situation to have two executives, each taking an independent position on major issues where the state needs direction. I think most of the criticism of the Attorney General's role, I don't really have that much of a row to hoe, even though I served as the Attorney General. I think from a personal perspective, it would have been more fun being an elected Attorney General, and I think I would have had a good a chance as anybody to get elected. So, but I, looking at how the offices functioned, I think that most of the criticism comes on a, is based upon a misunderstanding of what an attorney general does. And as John, as I think, started to open up, there really, there are a number of different functions that are performed by the attorney general. And you can split them up and you can identify some of them as being possibly items that, that might be handled in a somewhat different way. For instance, I think most people, most of the criticism I've heard of the attorney general that comes down to, you know, a factual situation has been that they didn't handle citizens' complaints, or that the opinions of the attorney general in administrative matters were not independent of the governor. Well, and there's a grain, on any kind of criticism, there's a grain of truth in what's being said. That is, let's say the attorney general does not take general citizens' complaints, and I think the legislature met that by establishing an ombudsman whose function it is to perform that role. The attorney general's office was never created to expect the attorney general to handle that too involves a conflict of interest in that office, and I think it's a sound idea to have a separate ombudsman. As far as the opinions you're talking about are not opinions relating to prosecution, they're opinions relating to administrative law. And I say, well, if you think that you want to have an independent opinion rendering individual, then really what you're talking about is establishing some sort of administrative court with the authority to issue advisory opinion. Because if you're talking about exercising a judicial authority, that is, if you're talking about exercising the issuing of opinions that are going to be binding upon the executive branch, regardless of what the governor's views on the matter may be.
That's certainly not the case, is it?
What?
That the attorney general's opinions are binding on anybody?
They aren't now, no. The attorney general's opinion are, well, they are binding. They're not, they're put this way. The governor is the ultimate attorney general. And if the governor doesn't like an opinion of the attorney general, he can tell the attorney general what to do with it because he commands the executive branch.
So can any citizen.
But if the attorney general issues an opinion relating to the management of the executive branch and the governor does not overrule it,
you're making the distinction.
An administrator that proceeds in violation of that is proceeding on his peril because you will get no legal
in-house and
no
public
legal support
for
it, and he may end up getting sued, and he's running the risk of having acted ultra virus his authority. He's way out on an individual limb.
I see your distinction.
So there's very few commissioners that really want to dispute an attorney general's opinion outside the administration. That's right, Chuck, isn't that?
I should have stayed away.
Unless you're dedicated to the support of the legal profession.
The governor has to have his own independent counsel, I say that the independence of that counsel is guaranteed by the function of an attorney. Now, you don't pay an attorney, and a governor doesn't pay an attorney general to have the governor hear what he wants to hear, because if it doesn't work, it's bad advice. And when you hire an attorney, you're hiring to hear what the law is, and that's what the attorney general does.
So they're
very rare exceptions where you're not going to give the sometimes I'll say this: you give the governor an opinion, and the governor says, "Do you mind not repeating that outside of this room?" And there are times when an attorney general is
true, but
quiet.
Don't tell anybody.
That's right. Yeah. That occasionally happens. And I think the attorney general, one of the arts of being an attorney general is ducking requests for an opinion now and then, and there are various techniques for doing that. As far as the, being in charge of the process and prosecution, I think that is an executive function. And I think that it is proper that the chief executive have, who has the responsibility under the Constitution for carrying out the laws, should have the responsibility for supervising that function. Though I'm not, and there has been, as far as I know, no complaint about that exercise. That is, that the prosecution, the criminal laws in this state, considering we've run through 20 years, is by and large fair and even and non-political. And that's particularly true if you look at the other states, the states that have elected DAs or elected attorney general, they move with the wind as far as the prosecutorial policy goes. And they get caught in elections, and they always like to have a few good hangings just before the election in order to get themselves reelected. And that's not equal justice, but I think there are serious problems with having elected DAs, elected AGs, and I think that's borne out by what's happened in the other states. As far as the internal organization, as John commented, the Section 26 board, which were so hotly disputed, is a practical matter. I don't think it's made an awful lot of difference. The Section 26 commissioners have responded like other commissioners. You know, a commissioner is a guy who has a job to do. He's a bureaucrat. Even if he's a politician to start with, he ends up, he gets into that job, he's got an administrator's job, and he starts behaving like an administrator. And the fact that he's got this board that he works with, that's just another constituency, and all commissioners have to deal with varying constituencies that that are interested in the work of that department. And the governor is either going to give commissioners a lot of freedom to run their departments the way they see it, or he isn't. And he isn't going to let a Section 26 commissioner have an awful lot more freedom than any other commissioner. As a practical matter, you know, when a Section 26 commissioner gets a call from the governor in a rage, his knees knock just like any other commissioner. I think that there have been some problems. Looking at problems from the organizational side, I'd say that the most difficult area, one that's not received much public attention, has been the performance of the mixed function agency. That is, the Constitution provides for having independent agencies that are quasi-judicial, and I think that overall, the performance of these quasi-judicial boards and commissions, I'm not going to name anyone in particular because the criticism is functional, has been left much to be desired. And part of the reason for that is they don't know which way they're coming from. That is, they don't know whether they're executive or judicial, and so they haven't responded according to the traditions of either branch of government. And there have been confusion as to the degree to which they're supposed to respond to executive leadership or the degree to which they're supposed to be super independent. And I'd say by and large, that has been a spot. I have no specific recommendations as to how you might go about clearing that up by constitutional amendment, but I'd say that's been, in terms of functional problems, that has been a problem all through since they first started creating.
Isn't the main problem the legislature doesn't give them enough money to get a staff to do their work?
Well, I'm not sure the staff knows what they're supposed to do either. You know, they're caught between the constituencies, the executive branch, the public, the parties being regulated, the users of the service. And they don't know where they're supposed to be. Maybe you can say it's a legislative problem, and the legislature is not adequately defined what the public interest is for these boards and commissions. But I don't. That maybe that's one way of addressing it. But I'd say that it's not just been a problem of not adequate financing. I'd say there's been some inadequacies in the appointments that have been made to these things, and which brings up another executive authority. Which is the confirmation power, and I say the confirmation power has been used, it seems to be largely unproductive. There are undoubtedly lots of pragmatic reasons why that's so, but you've not had really the time to sort of pause the investigation of confirmation appointments that, say, you might get at the federal level. I don't recall, there's been, as far as I know, no one, maybe Chancey, has anybody ever been turned down because of the confirmation hearing?
I think it happened this year, but it happened several years ago also.
Because of the hearing?
The result of a hearing.
People have been turned down, you know, when I think of the places of this little invidious, but I don't think that the people that have been rejected have been rejected on the kind of reasons that one is contemplating constitutionally, which is presumably both the ability, the policy focus that the person has, and the experience they have to perform in the function. And I've seen a lot of very inexperienced and unqualified people confirmed for jobs for one reason or another, and nobody really spends much time on that aspect of the confirmation power. As far as the problem that John addresses the lieutenant governor's position, I agree with him that the present system, constitutionally speaking, is unsatisfactory. I wouldn't call it the buddy system, because it's quite the opposite. It's the non-buddy system. The governor does not get to participate That's in any funny. Way in the selection of his running mate. And I'd say that the Hammond administration, and not the Hammond administration, Jay Hammond personally with Lowell Thomas Jr., have found what seems to me to be the solution to this problem, and I would think about ways to make that a constitutional requirement rather than just a convenience of the individuals involved. It does not work to have, we have a system that guarantees the second best, because anybody who's really worth his salt is going to be running for governor. And therefore, a lieutenant governor's job is sort of a testing ground for grade B politicians. I'm saying that institutionally, I'm not commenting on the qualifications of anybody. We've had some fine people have served in those roles. But I'm just saying the system is designed to discourage the very, or does not attract the very best people who are going to go for other roles in government. And I think that we ought to. It's been a problem on the federal level. I don't think John sort of suggests following the federal model. If you follow the federal model, you do get a selection, but there are problems with that in the level of participation of the public in selecting the person. My comments on the military article is really that it's sort of it's a quaint article in a sense. And My just sort of opening an avenue in that area, without drawing any conclusions, I'd say that when you look at what in the United States the state militia, the service that those people are involved in the last 100 years or so, it hasn't involved any of the things that are recited in the Constitution. And I wonder, the National Guard has served a lot of important purposes in this state, notably the disaster function. And my point about it is, I think that if we had started from sort of a conceptual baseline that did not consider this tradition John referred to, which made it sort of imperative to go that way, we might have come up with some other model other than the military model for dealing with that kind of issue and that kind of problem. But I'm not sure that military forms of administration are as well suited as we take for granted in meeting issues of this kind. There are a number of issues in the executive branch which were not anticipated or were anticipated poorly, and I'll just ring off about three of them. One is the reapportionment, it's not in the executive article, but it is the executive power, the government. We ended up, I think, with a fine system that you can't find out what reapportionment is when looking at the reapportionment article of our Constitution. Baker against Carr came down about 6 months in the spring after the Constitutional Convention, and one man, one vote made hash out of the reapportionment article. And because of the feuding of the basic power struggle between executive and legislative branch, nobody has really been prepared to tackle the job of writing that article. So in order to find out what's going on reapportionment, you just have to read court cases. And that's, you know, from I'd like to see it, you know, at least the way it is now codified. I think the way it is now is satisfactory, although I'm sure Mr. Croft has different perspectives from as a legislator.
Well, how would you word it?
I think that the way it is now doing is fine. I think it's a disaster to give the apportionment power to the legislature. I think it is desirable to have it in the executive branch. Another problem, the merit system. Incidentally, when the apportionment article was adopted, it was considered the very model of modern enlightenment of the Constitution. The method of equal proportion, and it lasted 6 months. The next modern thing that was that I would comment on was the merit system, which is considered the very model of the modernity for the, any government to follow. And it's more or less, it worked in a fashion for about 10 years. But it did not work as a merit system. That is, it is basically a seniority system as far as the pay scales go. Occasionally, the merit promotions are not based upon the merit system, but are based upon an executive filling a higher post and picking the best person to do it. But it doesn't have anything to do with the constitutional merit system, which simply ends up with these step raises, which if you ever try to deny an employee a step raise on a merit, you find out how much of a merit system it is pretty fast. The thing that's happened in the last decade, of course, has been unanticipated thing, has been the rise of government trade unionism, and I think that has finished off whatever was in the merit system concept constitutionally, and I think that area needs re-examination as to
how... You don't have that in the Constitution.
Maybe a Supreme Court case will clear it up and say, you know, junk, collective bargaining, yeah. Said the merit...
You don't have that in the Constitution? The Act of Congress that provided for statehood of Alaska required it to be in the Constitution. There was nothing we could do about it. Congress wouldn't have accepted the bill if it hadn't have been in there. But that's fine. I'm all for it. But you know what happened? The first month after statehood, the damn fool courts exempted the whole damn judicial branch from the merit system. And can you imagine if all the people who are supposed to be guarding our rights, taking care of the people, they exempt themselves, and I think it's disgusting that they've done it, and they've gotten away with it, too.
The last item I mentioned, in my kind of work you run into this thing, I don't think there are 10 citizens outside of the delegates, and maybe some of the delegates would have forgotten it. There's an article there that mandates having a parole system, which is also a very modern thing. And, you know, for those of you that are following what's going on in criminal justice today, the consensus of opinion in the criminal justice administration is parole boards ought to be junked. And I wonder whether we aren't going to have some problems, possibly constitutional disabilities, in junking the parole board when it's constitutionally mandated.
It doesn't mention parole in the Constitution.
Sure does.
No, it doesn't. The Constitution says that the rehabilitation should be the criteria that sentencing people.
Yeah, I told you. Where's, some of the delegates don't know what's in that Constitution.
Now, where's parole in there? I don't recall it. You right, tell so me where it is.
Section 21?
Right,
sir. Yeah. A parole system shall be provided by law. Section 21.
I understand correctly. then we adopt the principle of rehabilitation and punishment of criminals, which is completely ignored by the courts today. They're riding the winds of the moment. They'll get over it.
That's, I tried to keep it in the 20, but I didn't quite. That's about it. It would have been nice. You know, another executive issue is the where do you locate the capital? And it would have been awfully convenient if somehow the constitutional fathers had solved that one instead of letting us tear each other apart for the last 10 years over that issue.
They thought they had. They had a sneaky provision in here about the capital.
The courts
work.
Did it again. They undid that
work.
And the courts.
Andy Warwick can bring a perspective of a member of the current member of the executive branch, serving now in transition from Commissioner of Administration.
Thank you. I've had 4 years of experience in the legislature and 2 years of experience serving as Commissioner of Administration, so in a sense, I've had the opportunity to develop a perspective of the Constitution as it applies to both the executive branch and the legislative branch. Basically, I'll comment on several things that have been discussed here earlier and also add a few others to it. The issue of the lieutenant governor is an interesting one. 2 years ago, I ran for that office. And I have to agree with John Havelock on his perception of the role of the lieutenant governor. Although during the campaign I said, as every other lieutenant governor has said, that we will make the position a different position, it always resorts to the same position, and that is the only responsibility of the lieutenant governor, other than running the Division of Elections, is to serve as a successor if something happens to the governor. And I just have to agree with John that the principal fault with that is that if something does happen to the governor, you have second or third or fourth or even a lot less than that best serving as governor. And in these modern times, something frequently does happen to the governor. When I ran, I tended to side with Wally Hickel. I knew down deep in my heart that Wally Hickel probably would not serve 4 years and I would end up as governor of the state of Alaska if I should have to win that nomination. And quite frankly, that is really not the best approach for getting to be governor. I think the people of Alaska deserve some more honest way of choosing the governor if something should happen to, I should say, they deserve a more honest approach for choosing lieutenant governor if something should happen to the governor. How that can be done, I don't know. The delegates of the Constitutional Convention obviously wrangled with it for a considerable amount of time. And I'm not sure if they had to choose over again, if their choice would be any different. Back to the powers of the governor. Initially, the Constitution, and I think it still does, anticipated a very strong executive, and it created one. However, during the last couple of years, principally during the last couple of years, the powers of the governor have eroded. And they've eroded, I think, in several areas. One, in a conflict with the legislature, and two, a conflict between the governor